It is my pleasure to welcome you to the Barbara Jordan Conference Center. It is really terrific to see so many of you for such an important discussion today. We're very pleased to have you here. We're also very pleased to be hosting this event together with our friends from CSIS. And I would like to thank you, Steve Morrison, and his colleagues for their help and support in organizing this discussion forum. Madam Assistant Secretary, we very much appreciate your participation and look forward to your remarks. We're also very grateful to Leonard Doyle, U.S. Editor for Independent Newspapers of London, for agreeing to moderate this discussion, and also for our stellar panel, Jennifer Cook, Dr. Shannon Hayder, and Professor Robert Rotberg. The Kaiser Family Foundation, over more than 15 years, has worked extensively to help increase and better inform media reporting on the global HIV/AIDS pandemic, both in the United States and internationally, but most particularly in Africa. And it is the result of that work that we today are truly delighted to welcome Zimbabwean journalist and TV producer Hopewell Chinona. Hopewell, welcome. Over the past 3 years, Kaiser has partnered with CNN International in their well-established and prestigious annual CNN African Journalism Awards. And through this program, the most outstanding journalists in Africa across a variety of interests are recognized. Annually, more than 2,000 nominations are received, and award recipients are selected by a prestigious international selection panel. In 2005, Kaiser added to the CNN Awards a special award to recognize outstanding HIV/AIDS reporting in Africa. Hopewell is the 2008 recipient of the Kaiser Award, but more importantly, Hopewell was also judged the overall winner for 2008 of the CNN African Journalism Award. Hopewell's winning documentary graphically portrays the awful consequences of the economic and political crisis in Zimbabwe by focusing on its impact on people living with HIV/AIDS. As bad as the HIV/AIDS epidemic is in Zimbabwe, this piece also makes clear that the situation is greatly compounded by the economic crisis, food shortages, and the severe weakening of the public health system and other public services that are a consequence of the political crisis in that country. To give you a small snapshot of Zimbabwe, in January 2008, inflation was reported to be at 100,000%. Hopewell earlier this morning was telling me that a whole new concept had been developed for inflation in Zimbabwe of the quintennial percent inflation, whatever that means, 18 zeros, I was told. The continuing economic decline has created an increasingly desperate shortage of food and basic essentials such as fuel. Zimbabwe also has one of the worst HIV/AIDS epidemics in the world, but concern about HIV/AIDS are overshadowed by other survival concerns such as food shortages. Some 4 million Zimbabweans are estimated to be currently in need of food support. Between 2002 and 2006, before the intensification of the current crisis, the population is estimated to have decreased by 4 million people. In 2006, WHO estimated that life expectancy for women in Zimbabwe was 34 years, the lowest in the world. And 2 years on, it's probably even lower than that. And according to UNICEF, Zimbabwe has the highest number of orphans in proportion to its population than any other country in the world, most resulting from parents dying of HIV/AIDS. Inevitably, attention to Zimbabwe in the U.S. media and the broader public agenda has been subordinated to the momentous events, both good and bad, in this country and the grave economic circumstances confronting the whole world. But the increasingly dire situation in Zimbabwe and the looming humanitarian consequences begs the question, what should the world, and the U.S. in particular, do about it? When can world powers step in without appearing to prop up the Mugabe regime? And how can the non-government sector ensure that when the time is right, the U.S. and other global assistance is ready to go, appropriately targeted and well used? These are some of the key questions we hope you all will discuss today. And to help establish a backdrop for this discussion, we will now screen a short outtake from Hopewell's award-winning documentary, Pain in My Heart, following which Hopewell will make brief initial remarks, and he will later join the panel to answer questions. The video, please.
I decided to make a film on the HIV/AIDS situation in Zimbabwe. A film without political acrimony, as has become the situation in my country. Instead, I wanted to make a film that would capture the ordinary lives of HIV carriers and to let them articulate their predicament without political spin. I started my two-month filming journey by asking for permission to film at Harare's biggest hospital, Parire Nyathwa, named after the current health minister's father. The clinical director of Parire Nyathwa Hospital, a Mr. Sidin Makarau, simply said, "Regret can't help." Regret can't help did not deter me.
I think people really need to talk about it. Mm-hmm. Talk about it. If your daughter is HIV positive, talk openly about it. Mm-hmm. Just like this headache, flu, you know? Mm-hmm. The more we do that, the more we find solutions. Mm-hmm. But the more we shun ourselves and hide from the mere truth, we'll always have problems.
Two HIV/AIDS patients being taken care of by the River of Life Church, situated in Zimbabwe's capital, Harare, agreed to give me unlimited access into their lives and let me film their struggle with HIV/AIDS. 44-year-old Peter, twice divorced and a father of a 20-year-old son, a very lively man and comedian of some sort, and 27-year-old Angelina, a respectable single mother of two whose company I enjoyed very much. I respected the way in which she tried to endure her pain with dignity. People who, despite their desperate poverty, refused to use their illness to become perennial beggars. When I first met Angeline, her daughter Beauty was not in school because she could not afford the school fees for her. 30,000 Zimbabwean dollars, a mere 15 US cents. 7-year-old Beauty literally looks after her desperately sick mother and 6-year-old young brother. Angelina and Peter are being helped by the River of Life Church on the outskirts of Harare in an area called Mount Hamden. Their health needs are looked after by the church medic, Dr. Rutendo Bonde, assisted by Mike Kuda, who sees to their daily needs. Mike Kuda in Shona simply means mother of Kuda. That's how people in Zimbabwe address each other when they have children. The church initiative helps 55 HIV carriers, but can only afford to put 7 of them on ARVs. Peter is one of those. Angelina is not. I went to see Dr. Ratin Lovo, the head of the sexual health clinic, also referred to as the opportunistic infection clinic at Parire Nyathwa Hospital. I wanted to ask her why people like Angeline cannot get ARVs, which can help arrest the disease progression and live better lives.
For antiretroviral therapy, one needs to be prepared.
Yeah.
And then the question becomes, how long does it take for the healthcare workers that in that particular clinic to get that patient prepared for therapy?
Mm-hmm.
And you might find that some clinics will take 2-3 months, or they have such a backlog, so you may have a huge number of patients who are eligible for therapy, who are ready to start treatment, but not perhaps have enough healthcare workers, or maybe at that point in time not have enough drugs to actually start them on therapy, because we also, as healthcare workers, we have a responsibility to those that we have started on treatment. So we are forever looking at our drug supplies, or the national drug supplies. You know, so if we feel that there's a shortage, we might just decide that we should just go with treating the ones that we've already got on our books, rather than put new patients and then put those that started a long time ago on at risk. And that's the reality on the ground.
Yeah, I've been given a prescription by Dr. Bonde, and we've come to one of the biggest pharmacies in Zimbabwe, Plaza Pharmacy, to get a price quotation for ARVs? Well, I've just got my quotation back from the pharmacist. Caletra, one of the drugs that is used for HIV treatment, is 12 million. And to put it into perspective, a doctor in Zimbabwe earns about 6 million Zimbabwean dollars. So it will need to take them 2 months' salary to be able to buy that drug, which is for 1 month. But there are also other cheap drugs like Stalanev, which is a first-line drug, which costs about 2.2 million Zimbabwean dollars. I decided to talk to some of the hospital doctors who are constantly on strikes to find out why they embark on industrial action.
Because they're disgruntled. Yes, we want to save lives. The lives of the patients come first. It's difficult to take care of other people when you're having trouble taking care of yourself. You've got to worry literally about where your next meal is going to come from, especially with the current situation now, where you're going to get meat. For those of us who don't stay at the hospital premises, your transport, particularly if you don't live within a walking distance of the hospital. And you know, after 5 years of medical school, and for others, 5 years and a couple of years of working, and you still don't have assets like cars or your own place, or you haven't amassed just enough basic things like TV and a fridge, a stove, a bed, and so on. It's very, very frustrating.
As you're not looking very well, I mean, if anything, I'm getting a bit worried about how long she has in terms of staying alive. She's certainly worse than what she was yesterday. She's getting confused, and I think she has less strength.
Well, I would like to thank you all for coming and to thank the Kaiser Family Foundation for inviting me to come to Washington. I came to the United States in October at the invitation of CNN. So the Kaiser Family Foundation said, since you are in the States, why don't you come down to Washington? So thank you very much for inviting me. I made that film after I realized that it was difficult to tell the outside world, and particularly Zimbabweans living in the diaspora, about the problems that their compatriots are facing back home in Zimbabwe. The biggest problem at that point in time, and still now in Zimbabwe, is HIV and AIDS. And the biggest problem that we face as journalists in Zimbabwe is, how do we tell the story? There are so many laws that inhibit us from telling the story. Sometimes, you know, if you're seen with a camera, you're thrown into jail without being given a proper hearing because of the political situation. And also to hire out a camera, it costs $300 a day. Zimbabwean journalists earn an average of $30 a month. So it's practically impossible for them to tell the story. There are a lot of Zimbabwean journalists, brave journalists, who are competent enough, who could have told the same story that I told, but who were not fortunate enough to have access to resources as I have. I trained in Zimbabwe, finished in 1993 from the journalism school, and then decided to go and do my postgrad in the United Kingdom. After I finished my postgraduate studies, I worked for the BBC, and I decided to go back home after 9 years because I thought, you know, it was a good time for me to go and set up. I've always wanted to set up my own business. And when I got home, we were told that we could not work for international media. So since I was working for the BBC was banned. And then I tried to set up my own business to do my own productions, and I was banned as an individual. So I went back to Britain to start film, and when I came back home, I thought, well, I've got the equipment, why don't I make a film? So that was my first film.
And after I made the film, it was shown on local television. But unfortunately, the lady who sanctioned the film to be shown on television, she lost her job for that. And this year I was banned from covering the election because the responsible authorities for licensing journalists said there was a security risk for whatever reason, I don't know. But we continue to tell the stories in different ways, and we hope that, you know, the outside world will help us. Since I made that film, all those people who you saw at the hospital, they are at home because the major hospitals in Zimbabwe have now been closed. There's no medication. The medical school was closed last week, and schools have been closed. We are told by the institute that, you know, looks at what's happening in schools, that this year alone there's been 30 days of schooling for kids. So basically the whole year kids have been to school for 30 days and they haven't been able to write exams. And because of that, you know, the situation has become unbearable for Zimbabweans. People are living, they're eating wild fruits, competing with wild animals, waking up in the morning to try and get some food. Some of the stories, they're difficult to tell standing on a podium, but, you know, we have seen, we've gone into rural areas, you know, whenever we can, because going there and being seen with a camera is pretty dangerous as well. You can be beaten up to death because so many people have lost their lives. So, you know, I salute the work that my colleagues in Zimbabwe are doing. And like I said, I'm by no means the best. There are so many people who are doing a lot of good work, but for reasons that you all know, they can't come out and say, this is what we are doing, because they'll get arrested. Thank you.
Good afternoon. I'm Steve Morrison from CSIS. Welcome and thank you all for coming here this afternoon. I'm just thrilled to see so many people coming here for a couple of hours to talk about Zimbabwe. I want to thank the Kaiser Family Foundation, one of our most valued partners in the work we do on global health. I want to particularly thank Mike Sinclair, Diane Rowland, Jen Cates, Matt James, Alicia Carbow. I also want to urge you to come, if you can, December 2nd, when we will be doing a joint event with Kaiser over at CSIS focused upon the epidemic, the HIV epidemic in the District of Columbia, which will feature as our lead Shannon Hayter, who's here today talking from her expertise as former CDC representative in Zimbabwe, and we'll have the city administrator, Dan Taglerini, do the honors of introducing her. Congratulations to Hopewell. I do think that Zimbabwe as an issue has been subject to an undue amount of pessimism and frustration and resignation within policy circles over the last several years. There's many reasons for that. I think that there may be some change underway, but we shouldn't be rushing to that. But I think that we have today assembled to speak before us the people who have made the most serious commitment, among the most serious commitment to tracking this issue and attempting to think it through carefully and offer thoughts about the best way forward in terms of U.S. approaches and approaches by others. I'll be introducing Assistant Secretary Jendai Fraser, who I count among that group, at the forefront of that group, in just a moment. The next administration, the Obama administration, this issue will be waiting. It will be waiting at the front door. It will be waiting amidst an uptick of conflict and intractable conflicts in other places in Africa, in Sudan, in DRC, in Somalia, most notably. It's going to be in competition. It's going to carry a lot of baggage around the difficulties and frustrations of the last several years, and I think we need to push back on that. And, of course, Zimbabwe will be unfolding in this next phase in the midst of a global financial crisis and two wars in which the U.S. is involved, and multiple other big issues like Iran and North Korea that will weigh heavily. It's not, I don't believe, immediately clear that this will be a priority, but I think what we're doing today helps put new thinking forward and will be helpful. The situation's very fluid, I believe, more fluid than we give credit to it. We'll hear more today about the health dimension. What is a political crisis and a human crisis is becoming very much a visibly medicalized crisis, and we'll hear more about that, about the protests, about the cholera outbreaks, about the kinds of interventions, health interventions, that the U.S. should perhaps be considering and expediting in this particular moment. We'll hear more about the changes underway in South Africa. We have a change of leadership in Washington simultaneous with a complex and uncertain transition underway within South Africa. We have a global financial crisis which is reducing the prices for gold commodity markets, for platinum and for others, which is going to put a strain certainly on the coffers of the Mugabe government, among others, and perhaps aggravate the level of malnutrition and poverty that's already at an acute point within Zimbabwe. Let me turn to our speaker. Jendai Fraser is the Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs. She's had a remarkable longevity and a remarkable and indefatigable commitment to U.S. policy engagement in Africa, stretching back to the 2000 campaign. She served as the principal advisor on Africa issues in the Bush administration, in the Bush campaign. She became the senior director for Africa at the National Security Council, where she served for several years, and then moved as ambassador to South Africa, as U.S. ambassador to South Africa, and then as assistant secretary of state for African affairs. This is a period in which the U.S. government has trebled its assistance levels to Africa, launched complex signature historic initiatives, PEPFAR, MCC, U.S. Africa Command, has launched major diplomatic efforts, particularly concentrated on Sudan and other related horn-based initiatives. We're very grateful to Jendai for the level of commitment she's made and the fact that she's willing to come here and be with us today in a very, very busy schedule. So please join me in welcoming her.
Good afternoon. It's a real pleasure to be here. I think I'll get some water first, because I have a dry throat. Again, a good afternoon to all of you. I'd like to thank CSIS and the Kaiser Family Foundation for hosting us today, and I would especially like to congratulate our honoree, Hope Chinono, for his award-winning work, Pain in My Heart. I was very moved by the film, and I look forward to seeing the entire film. It's truly an amazing and powerful depiction, demonstrating like none I've ever seen of the human impact of HIV/AIDS in Zimbabwe. But more than anything, amongst all the tragedy, poverty, and despair, it also demonstrates the power of hope and humanity in the people themselves. Since I was last here to speak to CSIS on Zimbabwe, a lot has changed. The March 29th election offered a ray of hope for the future of Zimbabwe, but the government has been intent on squashing that hope with its campaign of violent repression leading up to the universally denounced runoff in June and continuing to this day with the cynical refusal to implement the power-sharing agreement signed 9 weeks ago. As a result, Zimbabwe is a broken, fragmented nation. It stands in sharp contrast to the emerging African continent defined by increased prosperity, promise, and democratic institutions. This afternoon, I would like to address the current state of Zimbabwean affairs, particularly the socio-economic and political crisis. But first, dealing with HIV and AIDS, it has been a particularly challenging for the Zimbabwean people. According to UNAIDS, in 2007, approximately 1.3 million adults 15 years or older were living with AIDS in Zimbabwe. Of those young adults and women were the hardest hit by the epidemic. In 2007, approximately 680,000 women over the age of 15 were estimated to be living with HIV and AIDS. The Mugabe regime's malfeasance and lack of transparency in its management of the donated resources is another significant impediment. For instance, funding through the Global Fund for AIDS, TB, and Malaria has been compromised following the disappearance of over $7 million from the Reserve Bank of Zimbabwe. Following international pressure, this money was subsequently redeposited, but it leaves strong doubts about the wisdom of channeling support funds for HIV and AIDS through the Mugabe regime. This is a tragedy for those who need the care the most. Especially disheartening, the elements of a previously well-maintained Zimbabwean healthcare infrastructure are crumbling. Medical care is limited, hospitals routinely turn patients away, and in fact, there is not one functioning public hospital in any major urban area. Just this week, doctors and nurses faced down the brutality of the Mugabe regime while peacefully protesting the sorry state of a once-model African public health system. In addition, the health situation has deteriorated so much under the Mugabe regime that 294 needless deaths from cholera have occurred in recent weeks. Despite the regime's egregious actions and neglect, the United States remains determined to provide assistance to the people of Zimbabwe. The United States, working through PEPFAR and in accord with our international partners, is providing antiretroviral treatment, prophylaxis, the counseling and testing to tens of thousands of Zimbabweans, and we are committed to supporting Zimbabweans to strengthen the will and capacity to take action to address HIV/AIDS at all levels of society. But until a responsible government is in place, we cannot fully expand the resources to effectively provide the treatment, care, and preventive measures to fight HIV and AIDS in Zimbabwe. To make matters worse, the current socioeconomic and political crisis in Zimbabwe has served to exacerbate this challenge. Inflation is through the roof. Some private sector experts place the inflation rate close to 13 billion percent. That is truly unfathomable. In Zimbabwe, some estimate that as much as half of the population has left the country, seeking whatever livelihood they can find elsewhere. And for those who do remain, they find most stores shelves bare, and for those who are fortunate to eat, they only get to enjoy one meal per day. In fact, the World Food Program predicts that 5 million Zimbabwean citizens will need food assistance by January. Sadly, all of this in a country once called the breadbasket of Southern Africa. Mr. Mugabe's central bank governor, Mr. Gideon Gono, went so far a few days ago as to blame the economic crisis on ordinary citizens, criticizing them for laziness and a failure to plant crops and tend to their lands. Mr. Gono's remarks are outrageous. It's time for Mr. Mugabe to stop playing this blame game and take some responsibility for the atrocious state of the country. In the meantime, the United States is providing large-scale food and other humanitarian assistance. In fiscal year 2008, so far, we have delivered close to $180 million in food aid. This assistance has helped to feed close to 2 million Zimbabweans. So when we look ahead, it's clear that as a result of the accelerating political repression and economic collapse, the people of Zimbabwe are finding it close to impossible to get by on a day-to-day basis. Since the Zimbabwean elections, the Mugabe regime and their supporters have continued to carry out targeted violence on a daily basis. In fact, we see evidence of a marked increase in violence in October as compared to August and September. And the violence is staggering. 190 opposition activists and supporters have been murdered since the March 29th election. It has also been reported by independent organizations that human rights violations in 2008 have more than tripled from 2007. The United States has repeatedly called for Mugabe to cease the violent attacks against democracy activists and civil society organizations, to respect the rule of law and allow the Zimbabwean people to exercise their political rights peacefully. Their efforts have been largely ignored. The international community needs to continue holding Mr. Mugabe's feet to the fire. He needs to cease abusing the rights of his citizens, as well as hold his supporters accountable for their violent actions. He must also respect commitments which he himself signed, such as the September 15th power-sharing agreement. While imperfect, the agreement offers an important starting point for democratic transition in Zimbabwe. Moving forward, the United States believes that Morgan Tsvangirai's insistence on implementation of a genuine power-sharing agreement is the only solution to the political impasse the country is facing. The MDC's resistance to accept a shared home affairs ministry is well-founded and reasonable. It is unrealistic to expect the MDC and ZANU-PF to share the running of this ministry. The United States continues to urge the Southern African Development Community and the African Union to address the continued stalemate over implementation of the agreement. We welcome the pro-democracy, pro-transition statements from Botswana and Lesotho and encourage Zimbabwe's other neighbors to speak out in a similar manner. But more needs to be done. For example, SADC should not recognize Mugabe as the president of Zimbabwe. After all, the people of Zimbabwe did not elect him, and he swore himself in after an election that was roundly rejected by SADC, the AU, the Pan-African Parliament, the EU, the UN, all rejected that election as neither free nor fair. SADC and the AU should continue to pressure the Mugabe regime to enter into a genuine power-sharing transitional government and to do so now. And we are prepared to do even more. We stand ready to augment substantially our development assistance to a government that makes credible and significant progress towards genuine economic and political reform. Much can and should be done to benefit the people of Zimbabwe. Unfortunately, the current regime and the situation it has brought about makes development assistance programs futile. And part of the saddest thing that I've seen since the September 15th signing is that as a U.S. government, we were very much focused on what now type of economic package can we put forward, how can we work with the international financial institutions to support a transitional government. All of that planning is now put to the side. In closing, Zimbabwe desperately needs assistance from the United States and other partners. It is time for Mr. Mugabe to provide a democratic window of opportunity to give the U.S. and the leaders of the international community the opportunity to help return Zimbabwe to its once coveted position as a respected African country. The people of Zimbabwe deserve this chance. The people, like those represented in Hopewell's film, deserve this chance, and especially those who continue to suffer unnecessarily by a regime that has systematically destroyed the cause of freedom in Zimbabwe. They also deserve this chance. Thank you very much, and I'd be happy to take questions, or perhaps we'll move straight to the panel. I'm not sure how they... Thank you.
Well, once again, thank you all for coming, and we've had some very forthright words from the Assistant Secretary, and I thought we should take this moment when we've got a transition taking place in the United States with President-elect Obama preparing, undoubtedly, at a great rate for the to take over in January. I thought it would be an excellent opportunity if we could perhaps frame the discussion we're about to have in terms of, to the extent that we can, what advice we can give the President-elect. We've described the situation of cholera breaking out in Zimbabwe. This could quickly spread into regional countries, you can quickly imagine a situation of regional peace and security being threatened. It is no longer possibly as discreetly Zimbabwean affair. So what should a President-elect Obama do? What is the advice that you would give him if you were a member of his national security team with this rapidly developing situation, whether politically on the ground, the health situation, the incredibly vivid movie film we've just seen from Hopewell? Because one thing I know, at least as a journalist, is that we see the world and we try and freeze frame it and we say, this is what's happening. This is what President-elect Obama's problems are going to be. They're going to be chasing down bin Laden. They're going to be dealing with Iraq. But you know what? Stuff happens. And what you think is a back burner issue can rapidly become a front burner issue. So shall we just imagine that for the moment? And with that introduction, would you mind if I asked you, to the extent that which you wish to, tell us how you would advise an incoming president, tell him what he shouldn't do, what mistakes may have been made in what we did so far, and how you'd like to see it carried forward?
Sure. First of all, I think that we have about 60 some or so days left in a Bush administration, and in those 60 days, I plan for there to be either a power-sharing agreement with Morgan Tsvangirai in as prime minister, or that would be the best, I think, scenario, or a scenario in which we have mobilized the region firmly against Robert Mugabe's continued illegal rule. So those, what I'm planning to do is hand off to that team either one of those two situations. Mm-hmm. So from there, how would I would advise? If Morgan Tsvangirai is the prime minister, I would advise the Obama team to work very, very rapidly to establish a common set of benchmarks with the international community, the region, and the international financial institutions to figure out how to start to restart that economy, to jumpstart that economy, some type of an emergency package to target it in specific sectors with under especially ministries that are accountable, whether those ministries are led by ZANU-PF or MDC, because I think there are accountable people in ZANU-PF as well, so that you can really get the economy restarted and the assistance flowing to the population. So that's if Morgan is prime minister. If, in fact, we have a situation where we've been able to mobilize the SADC countries to increase the pressure on Robert Mugabe, I would look for two possible scenarios. One is a rapid decline in security, i.e. the security forces fight back as such. And so you're looking at really an emergency response scenario. And I would also start really looking within ZANU-PF for leadership, because ZANU-PF would likely split under that scenario, and new leadership would emerge, and I would be looking to identify and make contact with that potential new leadership within ZANU-PF. So I would do some contingency planning on both fronts if we've actually mobilized the region. If I failed, then I would expect the Obama administration to continue to put pressure on the SADC countries, because I think that the leverage that the United States has and that, you know, the UN and others have is diminished by the posture of the SADC countries themselves.
Thank you. Just given the situation, which we're going to hear a little bit more about from the rest of the panel and which we've seen in the film and which you've described, do you think this should be more of a priority issue for the incoming administration? Do you think it's going to be a front burner issue?
You're asking me?
Yep.
I can't answer that question. should it be a priority? Within our Africa policy, it most certainly must be a priority issue. I mean, it really is a threat to all of the sub-region.
This is my point, that there is a potential threat to regional security. So can you see a dynamic whereby it forces itself right to the top of the table?
Yes, I can definitely see a dynamic where it forces itself to the top of the table, definitely.
Yeah. Okay. Shall we just move down the line, Professor? Would you?
Yes, I think we've heard from Gendai a very strong statement that we should build on, particularly the notion that we should persuade the African Union and SADC, particularly, not to regard President Mugabe as president. That's very important. But I'm much more cautious, pessimistic about the notion that that's going to happen on the Assistant Secretary's watch. I think it's going to take much longer, and it's going to take an Obama administration using the good offices of the first few days, weeks at most, of the Obama administration to put pressure, first of all, on South Africa, and latterly on SADC and the AU to change the dynamics within Southern Africa. On Friday night, I was with a leading president of Southern Africa at a distant place from here, and he said Morgan should take what he can get and just move on. I said, that's outrageous. I echoed what the secretary has just said. And he said, no, you don't understand. He's not going to get much anyway. It's better that he should take what he can get his foot in the door, be a slight Trojan horse. And that's all that's going to happen anyway. And I said, but surely you can, as a Southern African president, you can stand by the September 15th agreement. He said, well, if we can't get it, we can't get it. It doesn't matter. We must move forward. So we have to fight this, as the secretary knows better than I do, the lassitude in Southern Africa and in Africa, the pusillanimous approach of most presidents except for Ian Khama and the Prime Minister of Lesotho, Moses Sisili. And we need to put real pressure, because dynamic is not going to change. And I was with also an MDC leader yesterday who doesn't expect, this is a high MDC leader, doesn't expect improvement before April. So we really have to change the dynamic, and the Obama administration is the newest variable on the block. I don't think anything else is going to happen, Leonard, except one more point, which is that if violence breaks out in Zimbabwe soon everything, the situation will alter, but I think we shouldn't expect that at all. It's not a violence-prone situation, and Morgan Tsvangirai, for all his good offices, is not about to lead an insurrection.
Okay, thank you very much. Just a couple of thoughts. I mean, we have this first African-American president of the United States who he himself has said is going to bring about change around the world. The world is going to look at the United States in a different way. Robert Mugabe congratulated him on his election. I think Tsvangirai has said this removes the race card from Mugabe's armory of little tricks that he can play. Every time he opens his mouth, he seems to accuse the Brits of playing their colonial games, etc. So, Hopewell, is there a chance here for the, or is this just so much smoke and mirrors? Is there any possibility that the arrival of an African-American president of Kenyan descent on the scene can actually change the dynamic, and the two big leaders could sit down and talk about things properly, as we've heard him discuss about chatting with the Iranians?
That is certainly the hope in Zimbabwe. Zimbabweans are hoping that, you know, the arrival of Obama, I mean, the whole world is looking up to Obama to change things. And a lot of countries have got problems. There are a lot of troubles. Everybody's looking. I mean, Obama has got there's a burden of expectation on Obama, and he won't be able to deliver all that change. And the Zimbabwean government made it clear after Obama's election in the Zimbabwe Herald, which is controlled by the government, that we know that Obama is going into the White House, but it's not about Obama. It's not about George Bush. That's what they said. They said it's about the institutions. Mm-hmm. So they are already anticipating the issue of the race card being pulled away, and you know, they're saying, no, we've always known that George Bush is not acting in isolation. Mm-hmm. It's the American institutions that are fighting us. So I don't see much change, but I see Obama having leverage if he wants to. you know, and having support, I think, within Africa, like the Assistant Secretary said, change in Zimbabwe, as I see it, this is my personal opinion, change in Zimbabwe will only come if the countries around us, they push for change. There is no way Morgan Tsvangirai and Mugabe are going to sit and agree on something without pressure from outside from outside Zimbabwe. And a lot of, you know, leaders that I speak to, politicians in South Africa, I spoke to one president 2 months ago within the region, and he said to me, you know, look, there's nothing that we can do. This guy is perceived to be a hero in our countries. And when he comes to my country, he gets the largest standing ovation, more than me, the president. So it is difficult for me to do anything.
Right.
So unless there is that political will within the region, within SADC, to say, look, the situation in Zimbabwe is terrible. It's going to affect us because it's affecting them. Right now there's a cholera crisis on the border of Zimbabwe and South Africa. So it's going to affect them. It's a security issue. But until the leaders say, you know, we need to do something about it, nothing is going to happen. And people have spoken about the economy crumbling. But I'm yet to see an African government that is, you know, being kicked out because the economy is not working. Mm-hmm.
Well, let's use the opportunity of that point to move on to the issue of disease and epidemics. And we know about AIDS. AIDS is a tragedy, but somehow or other it doesn't seem to bring about political change because it's always other people who get affected. Cholera affects everybody and can flash through a society. Tell us a little bit about this, if you don't mind, Dr. Shannon, about how this could cause instability or change or whatever.
Well, I actually would build on what Hopewell was saying on the economy and say, you know, unfortunately, from my, you know, narrow viewpoint, health rather rarely causes people to march in the streets and overturn a government, whether it's our own government or anybody else. Healthcare just doesn't bring people to the streets. And to take it one step forward than that, if you are laying in bed dying of AIDS or taking care of someone who is, you aren't going to be marching in the streets. You have more pressing issues to take care of.
Yeah.
So I don't see cholera as much different from that, because I think there it just doesn't, in terms of the response it generates from human beings, it just doesn't come to that level of political overturn. That said, sometimes that leads to some things you wouldn't expect, meaning that public health, whether it's HIV or cholera, are actually much less politicized than even other humanitarian issues like food. So sometimes you actually have opportunities to intervene on and mediate these sequelae that aren't going to cause political overturn anyways without waiting for change in the other parameters.
Okay. Well, one thing which seems to bring about change in countries when there's trouble is the mailbag that the leader in the United States, in the United Kingdom, wherever, gets from his constituents complaining about things. Certainly this was the case for Kosovo, which got Tony Blair, you know, involved, and certainly got Bill Clinton involved. So looking at Zimbabwe, why is Zimbabwe not a kind of such a burning issue? Why is Darfur a bigger issue? Let's ask the question. What do you think?
Well, and I think, you know, we would like Zimbabwe to be a priority on the next administration's agenda, but the fact is there are big crises going on in the world, and there are big hot crises going on in Africa, in the Eastern Congo, in Sudan, in Somalia, and so forth. And one of the things with Zimbabwe is that it's been just this gradual war of attrition, where people are walking quietly across the border, making their way. People are dying quietly in the rural areas. We don't have the kind of media access, and I think that's why partly this film is so powerful. It really brings across on the human level, which is what moves, I think, moves Americans in a place that is not fundamental to U.S. strategic interests in, for example, the way a Somalia is. And I think that kind of reporting is going to be very powerful in evoking a response. I think the one thing about the cholera, it may not bring people to the streets in Zimbabwe or in Harare, but what it does do, it's a signal I hope, to the region and to the broader world that this is a system that is fundamentally broken now. It's beyond, okay, the hyperinflation. You're having sewage pumped back into people's homes, even in the most affluent neighborhoods. It may add to this constellation of issues that are going now, the total breakdown of the health system, total breakdown of the education system. Now, cholera is less about the health system than about the fundamental water supply. And people are going without water or driving to Durban to get bottled water. And it may be that, we've said this for maybe 6 years now. It's really reaching a tipping point now. But really, it really may be it.
Right. Well, maybe we take the opportunity to ask members of the audience if they'd like to speak. Do you want to take the microphone here, please?
Thank you very much. My name is Joe Davis. I'm with the American Federation of Teachers, and we have been supporting the teacher unions and the trade unions in Zimbabwe for quite a while and are deeply concerned about this issue. My question really has to do with the levers of power that the U.S. can use. My reading of the situation is that certainly there's a transition going on in South Africa. The election is not going to be until later next year. It's going to be hard for the U.S. or the new administration to put much pressure on South Africa in this transition period until the situation becomes clearer and more decisive. And Mbeki has been, I know the unions certainly don't see him as a neutral mediator, and he has supported, seems to be supporting Mugabe, so he's discredited as the key mediator in this dispute. The other countries in Southern Africa, the SADC itself and the AU, seem to be more supportive of Mugabe than they do of Morgan Tsvangirai. What are the levers of power that could be used to get the Southern African countries to move aggressively on this issue? It seems like not accepting Mugabe as the president of the country is highly unrealistic, if they have accepted him as the president of the country. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Would anybody care to take a look at that?
Sure, I will take a little bit of a stab at it. I think that they've not accepted the June 27th election, and so I think that it's widely perceived in the region that there's not a legitimate government operating in Zimbabwe today. The expectation was that they would move to. That's why they're talking about forming a government. There isn't a legitimate government, so I think that's the first step towards putting on that greater pressure. The challenge is that the way in which the framing of I think the mediator is that it's Morgan that's the problem. I think that the countries. The actual silent majority are opposed to Mugabe. And it's a matter of bringing out that voice. It's not a matter of changing their position. It's about bringing out their voice. And I think that once you start increasing the number of countries that are willing to openly state that the situation in Zimbabwe is unacceptable, I could just sit here and name the countries that feel that way, and you'll find that it's more of the SADC countries. The other problem is they haven't figured out yet what to do with the military, and that also stops the region from moving more aggressively against Mugabe or more in concert against Mugabe. And so we need to work with them to figure that out.
Okay, Professor Rothberg?
Just two quick points. Don't forget that the Zimbabwe Parliament is now under MDC control. with an MDC speaker, and it's just possible when they start meeting again that they can begin to enact legislation which moves some of this issue forward. Secondly, we mustn't overlook the influence of China. Mm-hmm. And we really have to, the Obama administration, maybe Jindai can do this before she leaves office, but we need to cut some back-channel deals with China. China's supplied aircraft, buses, which aren't working, by the way, chemicals in the water supply, which aren't working, but also really is the only prop of the military at the moment. They've also got farmers growing tobacco. So if China can be persuaded to pull back and to put pressure on the Mugabe government, it might produce more leverage than anything we've talked about so far.
Just one thought I had watching Hopewell's rather extraordinary movie is how, it is, of course, incredibly difficult to operate as a journalist in Zimbabwe. As a foreign editor in London, I remember sending people on golf trips to Zimbabwe to try so they could get in the back door. And they left. The local journalists had to stay and endure the beatings and the trauma. But my point is this, is that it's not rocket science and it's not that expensive to help journalism grow and to get the messages out and get the stories out. I mean, we've seen how bloggers have written the election in this country this year. It's somebody with a little tiny camera. That size, it's not $500 a day. It's about $50 to buy. How they've managed to transform the state of the politics, the political discussion in the United States. So it's surely a lot cheaper to, you know, rain cameras on Zimbabwe than it is to drop bombs on Mullah Omar or wherever he is. Why are we not doing this? Why is there not more interest in getting the story of Zimbabwe out to the American people? And likewise, getting the American people involved in the story of Zimbabwe or the world people. Could anybody enlighten me on this? Tell me where we should be going, what we're doing wrong.
I have actually a question for Dr. Fraser, and I just want to say thank you for your leadership, and I'm going to go with the time for hope, and I hope in the 60 days you are able to put some structure around the discussion. But I heard recently Bishop Tutu speak about Zimbabwe, and he said something that I thought was very interesting in light of the gentleman's question, that there is a historic relationship with Mugabe and who he has historically represented, and that the leadership has found it extraordinarily difficult to speak out publicly at all about this gentleman because of who he historically has been and what he has represented on the continent of Africa. And until I heard Bishop Tutu speak about this, it was unclear to me these dynamics. And I just was wondering if you would share a little bit about kind of that reality. I mean, Mugabe was such an incredible leader for so many emerging democracies on the continent, and now to, you know, there's a conflict. There's an internal, emotional, affective conflict going on. Can you speak a little about that and sort of further enlighten us? Because it helped me to understand some things.
Yeah, sure. I think that was certainly true, but it's diminishing, a diminishing factor. It is certainly true that the SADC countries, as frontline states, were very linked together during their liberation movements. And so there is that solidarity as liberation countries, liberation movements. And some of the older leaders felt that commitment of being in the field together. And I think that President Mbeki in particular has that feeling. President Nujoma had that feeling as well. But increasingly, the democratic countries around Zimbabwe have had new elections, and some of the new leadership doesn't come through that same history, and therefore are more prepared to speak out about democracy today, not liberation, you know, 20 years ago or 10 years ago or I guess 30 years ago at this point. So I do think that dynamic is changing, but I also think that continues to be in Southern Africa and in some of these countries like South Africa in particular, a sort of hero image that was there of Mugabe. You stood up against the white people, you know, and it's just on that level. But today, when especially after the March 29th election in which he rained terror on his population. I think the people in South Africa and other places are starting to say, wait a minute. You know, so I think that that dynamic is diminishing, and which is very positive and helpful for us.
Go ahead, Jennifer.
Yeah, I do think that phenomenon is still fairly powerful, even potentially with Zuma, who, although his rhetoric prior to the dismissal of Mbeki was, you know, we're going to really knock heads together, I think he still psychologically has that block to moving forward. And I hope, you know, the next administration may have a chance to kind of reframe their relationship with South Africa, kind of balancing some of the more tense spots with and just a more constructive relationship in that way. In terms of leverage, I think we do need to reframe our engagement with SADC a little bit and move beyond SADC on the Zimbabwe issue, because that mentality is still very strongly rooted there. But you do see leaders outside of SADC beginning to speak. You have Raila Odinga, who spent plenty of years in jail, saying, you know, just because he liberated the country doesn't mean he owns it. Museveni being more critical. Angola, which has been a traditional supporter of Mugabe, Dos Santos saying some critical things. And perhaps the way forward is to look not to SADC fundamentally to change this, although there are some leaders in SADC, and I think there are divisions emerging, but to try to create a new kind of coalition of the willing, it's a bad term, but, you know, to try to move this forward, even elevating it to the Security Council.
Okay. We have a question right here in the front.
Thank you very much.
I'm Ben Abassi
from the Foundation for Democracy in Africa. I'll make a couple of comments, then I'll probably ask a question. It's interesting. I live in South Africa. I'm here for 4 months. And we've seen the debates going on about the Zimbabwe for the last 4 years. And it's hard to pinpoint, you know, issues that you can say, how do the leaders in Africa think versus how do the people in Africa think about Zimbabwe and what Mugabe represents? And everybody here is saying the same thing. You're all correct. But the challenge is the recent election of President-elect Obama is spinning a dynamic that we've not thought about yet, is that leaders have been excused for so many things. You know, the Cold War era and its challenges and what came out of Africa. Now, people are going to look up and say, wait, we, youths can change something. Obama is seen as a young man. And a lot of young leaders in Africa are going to start getting engaged now in politics. They're going to say, wait, if he can do it, we can do it. And we're going to see dynamics where people are going to like stand up for, like never before, and they're going to say, we're going to change things. We're going to make things happen. Now, my promise, will they be supported? And if they receive support, will they be seen as stooges of the West? Because that's another problem. You know, you're going to be looked up with suspicion when people say, oh, he's receiving funding, he's receiving cameras, you know, and it's a problem. That's the first thing. Now, ma'am, my question to you is, you said something about if, let's hope Morgan Tsvangirai becomes prime minister, and if he does, the first thing should be, I'm going to use this word, it's not your word, my word, a bailout to Zimbabwe. How do you work that out, and how is it going to be administered? And if it is administered, what are the effects? I mean, everybody's going towards a bailout right now. Is it that we're going to be bailing out everybody? Because if you bail out Zimbabwe, you're going to have to bail out all the African countries and other situations you have there. Now, and the second question is, you know, we have to reframe our perspective on issues of dealing with countries in international relations. First, we would go, let's isolate them. But we found that increasingly that when you isolate somebody, you're giving him the opportunity to consolidate and do worse things that he would have done when we could have engaged him and said, wait, we know you have genuine concerns. We also have genuine concerns. Let's meet in the middle. What's the U.S. government stand on this perspective of engagement and not isolation?
Well, I'll answer your second question first and then the first question last. We do engage the Zimbabwean government, and our ambassador has met with President Mugabe or Mugabe, you know. He met with him when he was president. He has met with senior officials in that government, ministers in that government. So we are through our embassy, we do engage. So we don't have any policy of not engaging with ZANU-PF and its members and its leadership. We certainly are trying to isolate as well, but we're trying to do that from the point of view of targeted sanctions against specific individuals to change their behavior. We, of course, have already taken action in the Security Council, and we will continue to look to take action in the Security Council. This is where China becomes very important. China is an ally of South Africa on the Security Council, and if, in fact, you had the new president, Molante, taking a different posture in the Security Council about bringing pressure, more pressure on Zimbabwe, then we might be able to get more action in the Security Council. I think it's an important avenue for action. So I think we can do both. We can engage the government, because the whole point is not that we're opposed to ZANU-PF. We want to strengthen democratic forces. We want, you know, the abuse of the population to end. We want a return to democracy in Zimbabwe. And if on a dime ZANU-PF, you know, acted in that accord, then we would be working with them. Which brings me to the question about what's the nature of this engagement and what will there be a bailout. As I said, we were already doing planning based on this. I think the first thing is emergency assistance to the ministries that deal with health, you know, that the social affairs ministries, health, education, and I think that we should look as donors to again, as if those ministries are accountably led, properly led, responsibly led, we should look to put an infusion into those ministries as direct assistance, emergency assistance to the population. I think in terms of restoring economy, we need to collectively work out a set of benchmarks of economic reform. You can't just drop money into the economy and expect it to actually lead to true jump-starting of a sustainable economy. So we would work very closely with the Africa Development Bank, for example, to set up what those benchmarks are for turning on international assistance, for looking at addressing the debt, you know, Zimbabwe's debt issues, for looking at an IMF or World Bank program starting up again in Zimbabwe. But I think that really would require us collectively coming together so it's done in a very coordinated and measured basis based on performance from the government itself.
Thank you very much. I think there's a question down at the back we can talk about.
So, hi, I'm Joseph Johnson. I'm a medical student in Philadelphia. I have two questions. First of all is on the politics. You've mentioned Angola and Kenyan leaders in terms of their influence, but what about Tanzania? They're a country that's accepted a lot of Western aid, but is not really seen as a stooge of the West. They also have a role, I think, in the SADC where they would be able to exert pressure on Zimbabwe a little more, and why have we not mentioned them yet as a country? Secondly, what do you think the impact of gold mine closures in eastern Zimbabwe will have on the government's ability to maintain itself without much external support? For instance, what comes to mind for me is Zinwa in particular will lose its ability to be funded even more when there's no gold for the government to trade. Secondly, the security forces, those salaries will continue to not be paid if the government doesn't have gold as a heavy metal that it can trade for foreign currency. So what impact do you think that will have in the coming weeks and months?
Thank you. Who would like to tackle that? Professor Rothko?
Jennifer? Well, I was just going to say on Kikwete. Actually, Kikwete did make noises earlier on, but at a SADC summit last year, but appears to have been cowed by Mugabe, who did the equivalent of banging his shoe on the table and cowing a number of voices at that moment that were speaking out against him. I think Kikwete could play an important role, particularly because he's in the chair of the African Union right now. But because of that also, that may block, if he's not willing to become more active on Zimbabwe, that could block the African Union from becoming more engaged on the issue. So I do think he's someone that we should be working with. Popular sentiment within Zimbabwe, within Tanzania, is also mixed, and you still hear some of the defense of Mugabe as the liberation leader and people buying into that rhetoric, not so much as you did maybe 3 or 4 years ago, but there is still that effect is still there.
I think few people expect any dramatic changes from the Zimbabwean government. That seems to be the general perception. But given that, and given, this is really a question for you, Sean, given the disease issues and the kind of pandemics that are occurring, is there a case for kind of just grassroots involvement by organizations across the world to bail out the Zimbabwean people, you know, one-to-one, rather than going through governments where they've worked obviously very hard and come up against brick walls all too often?
Well, I think there's opportunities to deal with health while we're hoping and working for the political and thus the economic situation to rebuild. And I think before I get into that, is it government-based or community-based? I think maybe just a little plug to build on the secretary is about health diplomacy.
Yeah, sure.
Part of the reason there's the opportunity to potentially, quote-unquote, bail out, you know, on health issues immediately is because we've been practicing health diplomacy very effectively as the U.S. Embassy there under PEPFAR. We have standing relationships with the Ministry of Health that we work day in and day out on programs with and have agreements with and monitor funds with. And that's because the Ministry of Health is largely a technocratic ministry. Leadership, not completely anymore, you know. But on those lower levels of working day-to-day with other competent civil servants, when the permission is there, a lot can get done. And it's only occasionally that the permission gets in the way. I point that out because a lot of public health interventions can't happen person by person. So the water system, a CBO can't have access to the water system to go clean it up for cholera. CBO can be supported to go out and do health education to help people who've never had to boil their water before learn that it's important to bail water, help provide fuel, and the kinds of things to do that. So there's the possibility even now, and even under the hardest time, for a multi-sectoral response. And I think the people of Zimbabwe recognize health-related, humanitarian-related aid from the people of the world as a people-to-people investment,
sure,
and not as a sanction or an investment in the Mugabe government.
Sure. I think there's a couple more questions right here, please.
Thank you, sir. My name is Godfrey Sikipa. I work for an organization called Management Sciences for Health here in D.C. in a previous life as the permanent secretary in the Ministry of Health in Zimbabwe.
Welcome.
As a Zimbabwean, one hopes that in the next few weeks, in the next few days, or be it in April, there will be some political solution. But I want to focus my comments on the unfolding health crisis. Cholera, and the other thing we didn't mention, is the thousands of people that are currently on treatment for AIDS who are now not able to access treatment because of the closure of Harare Hospital, because of the closure of Pariri Natural Hospital, and some of these people are close relatives that we talked to yesterday, last week, and they are being impacted right now. My question is, to what extent is the international community, U.S. government, foundations, and others willing to do something about the unfolding health crisis? Hopewell mentioned the brave health workers that continue to soldier on under very difficult circumstances right now. I've also been impressed by the Zimbabweans in the diaspora, their willingness to jump forward and do something. But I think they need some assistance. So I'm appealing to the U.S. government and foundations and the others to address the unfolding health crisis.
It's an excellent question. And maybe I could ask Zindai, has enough been done? Is enough being done? I mean, is this an issue that's been enough resources have been pushed into, whether by foundations, by governments, whatever. It does seem to be something that's emerging.
Well, I'm never one to say enough has been done. It's just not my nature. So obviously we can do far more. And, you know, I've given some of the figures of what we're doing and how we're doing it. And certainly we can go back and look more carefully to see if, you know, given the specific current situation, if there's something more that we can do. We'll do that.
Anybody down the line, Professor Rothberg, do you have any
ideas? There's an underlying notion that what Zimbabwe needs is external help. It certainly does. But it also, the Zimbabwe people need to be empowered. And the best way, of course, of empowering Zimbabweans to take on all these issues, gold or no gold, is to create security so that Zimbabweans who are in South Africa and Botswana are able to come back. A. B. The quickest fix is going to be a macroeconomic fix to enable the complete dollarization, which is ongoing, and the creation of a currency board or something like that would be an interim step critical. And then the Zimbabweans can mostly do it themselves. Clearly, assistance to the water supply and assistance on a short-term basis for health interventions are very important. But once the economy is taken out of the hands of the corrupt politicians and military people in Zimbabwe, Zimbabweans can do it themselves, even in this very difficult international atmosphere. We haven't talked about the one thing that is happening right now, which is going to impact Zimbabwe for a full year, which is the insufficiency of plantings. There is no maize now. There's going to be less maize when the planting season ends. The World Food Program is being interfered with all the time. World Food Program persistently predicts a third to a half of Zimbabweans are going to go hungry. So the one thing that we are doing and need to do more of is try to find ways to get food relief into the country, again, on a short-term basis. Because once Mugabe's gone and credit is restored to Zimbabwe farmers, black and white, mostly black and Chinese in this case, can begin to plant maize in a way which enables crops to grow and Zimbabwe to feed its hungry itself. The problem now is we have a corrupt oligarchy running the country, which is siphoning money out on a daily basis and taking advantage even of the poverty today by arbitrage and so on.
Sure. I think we've got a question right here, if I'm not mistaken.
Thank you. I'm Pam Barnes, CEO of the Elizabeth Glazer Pediatric AIDS Foundation, and I did want to address your question. The foundation is one of the largest providers of HIV/AIDS care, particularly to pregnant women in Zimbabwe, and I had the privilege of being in the country twice this year. And for all of the many issues, Professor, you just touched on, managing a team mostly of Zimbabweans in Zimbabwe providing these kinds of services is a challenge in terms of paying our staff. We are now paying our staff in food coupons and fuel coupons because the currency is worth so much less even at the end of any given day. I do have to say, Assistant Secretary, that we are enormously grateful there for the support of Ambassador McGee. We have been able to keep working largely because of the support of the ambassador. We are supported there by PEPFAR funds, by UK Fund for International Development, by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And I say that because we work in close collaboration with UNICEF and other agencies on the ground. I do believe that the spirit of people working in Zimbabwe, and in our case, Zimbabwean staff working there, is to keep going and to keep working. But I must tell you, when I sit across from our country director and our staff, and I see how difficult it is day in and day out for them simply to get to work and to be able to move around safely. It is an incredibly challenging situation. But the spirit is there. People are working. And I don't see any of our folks saying that they're not going to continue doing that. So I do think there are a lot of great pieces of work going on the ground. You know, the issues around African Union and other support are now critically important.
Thank you very much.
Can I add on?
Yes, of course. Yeah, go ahead.
Just to add a comment in response to Godfrey, too. And I think, you know, a couple of weeks ago at CSIS, Peter Piet did his sort of 10-year retrospective, you know, as he's coming to the end of his term for UNAIDS. And I think there was a great phrase that he used describing about diving into expanding AIDS programs. And he said, you know, we don't have time to wait. We don't have time to wait for everything to be perfect when it comes to health and HIV. We don't have time to wait for all the systems to be working before we start doing something. And I think, you know, there's two areas that limit that are really perceptual barriers on the international front about infusing more resources in for the health response. One is very much tied to, is it politically wrong to do so? Will we unsettle movement towards change by infusing supports for health? And the second side, I think, is it feasible? Will it accomplish anything? And I think that's actually a bigger barrier for most people than the first, even though people will tell you about the first more. Is it feasible? Should we bother? Will it accomplish anything? One, on the fiscal side, can we manage the monies and get them out there to get the resources? I would say it's difficult, and there have been potholes, but there have also been a lot of successes. But second, on the actual capacity and human resource side, and as much as we talk very easily about the brain drain in Zimbabwe and the lack of resources, we don't talk enough about the talented people like Hopewell, like Dr. Nlovu, the senior doc that was in this meeting, like your staff that you mentioned, who have chosen to stay. We have some of the most talented, hardworking, dedicated medical providers in the world who have plenty of other options, who have chosen to stay and deliver services, and they're there, and they're soldiering on. And the biggest barrier for a lot of them day to day is not having the tools of the trade. It's really hard to hang on if someone's in front of you that you know how to cure or you know how to treat, and you can't give them anything. So for anyone who is thinking that the reason not to consider infusing resources to support health is that it's not possible, it's not feasible, it won't accomplish anything, I'd like to propose that it is feasible.
Sure.
And it would work.
Yeah. I'd like to just go back to Hopewell again, to having talked to us a little bit about the role of the journalist in Zimbabwe, because it sounds absolutely terrifying that you can't even go out and do your job without getting potentially picked up and thrown in jail. Maybe you could just tell us a little bit more about that.
I think the biggest problem that we have in Zimbabwe is that, you know, there's a law, and I know that one of your journalists has been a victim of that law, Access to Information and Protection of Privacy Act. There's a body which can just give you a phone call and say you're not registered anymore. If you are seen practicing journalism, you will be arrested. There are so many journalists, that's why I said there are so many journalists who have been beaten up, and some journalists have been killed. So a lot of people are now afraid to go out there and do their work because you will be killed.
Sure. What I was also asking, what I was just wondering, is whether health workers, people who have been trained in the West, for example, people who have access to computers, whether they should be involved in getting the word out. Because I'm not so much talking about formal journalists, but citizen journalists whom we've seen in action in this country. We see them all over the place. Is there a role? Do you have a view on this, Zendai? Is there a place for more information coming out of Zimbabwe from the health workers, the professionals, the diplomats?
Well, I mean, I think that the March 29th election really speaks to the type of issues that you were talking about, cameras, actually cell phones with cameras on them. It had a huge impact on the credibility of the count,
yeah,
where people went and actually took pictures of the returns, where teachers and citizens were at the polling stations taking those pictures, making sure that those returns weren't changed once they were centrally reported. And so, yes, citizen activism is extremely important, and we've seen it, and we've seen it work. And certainly we want to support it and continue to support it. So
great.
There's okay. a role.
I wonder, though,
yes, please, go ahead.
Just directed to Hopewell, though, if, for, you know, for a medical worker who's got plenty on their plate, the, you know, is it going to be feasible for them to get politically involved, risk even doing what they're doing and so forth? I mean, is there a pervasive aura of fear kind of on that?
Yeah.
I think a lot of medical people, they've stepped out of, you know, out of the shell. And, for example, that film, I was banned from filming it at the hospital.
Right.
But it took a doctor who said, look, you've been banned, but let's go and film. I want people to know what's happening inside my hospital.
Sure.
And like the assistant secretary said, there are a lot of people who took their cell phones, you know, to make sure that they record the results. In fact, it was so difficult for those who used to cheat.
Yeah.
To cheat because the results were displayed outside the polling station and people went with their cell phones and took a picture. And some of the people were actually managed to send some of these pictures, you know.
By text message.
They sent them abroad to CNN, you know, the iReport. I was amazed that, you know, people were sending, they were sending these things as far as America, Britain, to say, I'm at my polling station, these are the results.
Yeah.
But the problem that journalists face, like I said, is access to equipment. They don't have equipment. There are so many people who would say to you, I'm prepared to go and get the pictures. But they don't have the equipment because the equipment is expensive. There are few people like me who have the equipment, and it's difficult to be everywhere. And the other problem that we have in Zimbabwe now is, whereas in the past, the former police service would harass you, now we have militias who are not accountable to anybody.
Right.
So if I were to go to the countryside today to do some work, I would get beaten up by militias who are not accountable to anybody.
Sure. Great. We're close to wrapping up, but let's take another couple of questions if we can. Go ahead. We'll come back to you in a second.
Can I?
Go ahead.
Isidore Kayembe, I'm from New York. Oh, microphone, sorry.
Yeah.
Isidore Kayembe is my name. I'm from New York. I just came because I read it on the internet.
Fantastic.
My first question and contribution to Hopewell, I think for the problem of cholera, which is a reality, there is no tradition of boiling water in Zimbabwe. When you are coming like from Central Africa going to South Africa, that's the first country where normally you can drink. In the past you were able to drink from the tap instead of, you know, going to buy like water in the bottle and things like that. The comment mainly is about TB. I don't know where the data you get them from, but it was like on the lower side because it's supposed to be about 65% of the HIV patient. My main question is to Madam Secretary. I would like to say this. Mugabe really is a reality, you know, is someone who is known, who has been supported, and so on. But for the time being, as we are in the grassroots, I'm not from Zimbabwe, I'm from Congo DR, we've seen that he's not supported anymore in the population. One of the main reasons, when you look at through Palm Tree, going to Botswana, you know, sometimes people, they cross just to get, you know, the basic food, things like their chest, you know, sometimes they are deported because after 90 days when the work is made to get a bit of money, that's enough, they have to cross back and maybe change the passport and so on. But we've seen like some 10 years ago in Congo, I'm from Congo DR, the government of the USA, that's how we came to know Bill Richardson, who is New Mexico, he came with a letter to dismiss Mobutu, to give him and say, go. Why? You can't prepare some, you know, you are like on the going side.
Thank you. Okay.
You have 60 days. After 60 days, you won't change anything. Please, Madam Secretary, why you can't give a letter today to Mugabe to say, please go, you know? And for Mobutu, it was done. Mobutu was very powerful.
Okay, thank you very much.
History of liberation and so on. Oh, sorry.
That's fantastic. Can we just, I think you've made the point extremely well, and I know the ambassador is going to, I know Nai is going to give a brief answer, I'm sure, to that.
I guess my immediate answer is my speech was a letter to Mugabe.
Exactly. Well, it was very powerful indeed. I'm going to take the opportunity now just to wrap it up. We can take bilateral questions, I'm sure, later, but let me turn to Steve again just to draw some concluding remarks for me.
Well, thank you all. Thanks to all of our speakers. I neglected to mention Ino Isong from Kaiser, who helped very much engineer this event. But I want to extend thanks to Jendai, Leonard, Bob, Jennifer, Shannon, and Hopewell for really an excellent presentation. I think there are reasons to be hopeful, to leave this room with a little bit more hope about the end of this administration, the beginning of the next one. And I hope that out of this, one thing happens, which is that a transitional dialogue around Zimbabwe begins in earnest, because I think we saw today there's a lot of thinking, and that transitional dialogue hasn't yet begun but could begin right away. So that's one point. Reasons to be hopeful about the Obama administration on this side: there's a lot of high-level knowledge of Zimbabwe within the incoming transition team. We could name individuals, but there's a lot of individuals who know a lot about Zimbabwe, have strong personal linkages, have done good work. Hillary Clinton herself, if she becomes the Secretary of State, has made some very strong statements in the course of the campaign. Quite unusual. We should look at those. There is the possibility of the honeymoon period of Obama's influence. We're in the period of rebuilding our bilateral relations with South Africa and with Angola, potentially. We should make this a central dimension of that. We have strong ties with Botswana. We can leverage the Botswana leadership and the position within the region. We have an intact embassy with a courageous leadership. We should make full use of that. I think we've underestimated the courage and the contribution that Ambassador McGee and his staff have made. We can better use the UN Security Council, better use WFP, better use our own special humanitarian capacities. And don't forget, we haven't really talked much about Congress, but we do have leadership on Zimbabwe in Congress, Senator Feingold in particular. That can turn out to be very important. I thought the point made by the former Permanent Secretary in Health is an excellent one. There are interests and capacities on the private foundational side and an official side that can be brought to bear in working with diaspora and medical personnel inside Zimbabwe to try and map a more coherent reconstruction strategy. There's been discussion around that. There's been preliminary thinking about that, but we have not seen that carried forward, and I think that was an excellent point. And I think much more can be done on the media, as I think Leonard is pushing us on. ITN and others have done much more in Somalia than one had ever estimated was possible. And that has had, you know, Lehrer NewsHour, others have made very, very astute, deft use of the courage and the innovation. And perhaps we should be thinking a little bit more about that. And I think, Hopewell, you've been an inspiration to many of us here with your courage and innovation. So with that final thought, please join me in thanking everyone here.
Yeah, you get the medal.
Rex is going to love it when I...
Thanks very much.
Okay.
Great. Well, that was your summing up. It's terrific. Oh, turn it off. Might say something.